Welcome to the Being Human podcast, brought to you by Relate Malaysia. Join us in our conversations about what makes us human and why we think and behave in the ways that we do. We'll talk about mental health, emotional well-being, and how we can sometimes feel on top of the world, and other times like life calls for a large tub of ice cream and a big spoon. So come on in, relax, and let's explore this puzzle of being human together.
Hello and welcome to the Being Human podcast. My name is Dr. Chua Suk Ning, and today I'm joined by Dr. Robert Leahy, a renowned psychologist and author who has dedicated his career to transforming lives using cognitive behavioral therapy. As the director of the American Institute for Cognitive Therapy in New York and the clinical professor of psychology at the Weill Cornell Medical College, Bob has published numerous books that has been instrumental in sharing the efficacy of CBT in its application to the treatment of depression, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorders, and emotion regulation. Bob's work extends beyond clinical practice, as he has also widely published on the application of CBT to the therapeutic relationship, transference and countertransference, resistance to change, and beliefs about emotion regulation that can underpin problematic strategies for coping with or responding to emotions. His books have been translated into more than 20 languages, and his latest book, If Only, Finding Freedom from Regret, guides readers on how to get unstuck on regret and make decisions with more clarity and confidence, which we will be talking about in this episode. Welcome to the show, Bob. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me on, Suk. Looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. I've read your book. I can highly recommend it to all our listeners. It's just thought-provoking, but also very practical and very useful. I think for everyone, because everyone, as you say, experiences regret in our lives, but it's not an emotion that we enjoy. And why is that? Like, why do you think like we don't want to regret things in our society?
If we think about the function of emotion, we can get to why it has to be unpleasant. Like, if you think about hunger as a sensation, let's imagine if you had no experience of hunger or thirst, what would happen from the evolutionary point of view? You'd starve to death or become dehydrated and die. The same thing with physical pain, you would keep bumping into things and break all your limbs. Regret is a kind of a warning that something went wrong and maybe you shouldn't do it again. Maybe you should learn from it. Maybe you should avoid that in the future. And it's also something that we can anticipate that could help us make better decisions. Because if I overdrink or overeat or use drugs or, you know, spend money I don't have, I might regret it. So regret has to be unpleasant to motivate us, but I can talk about ways of using it productively and ways that you can avoid getting hijacked by it so you don't spend years regretting things you did.
I mean, you're describing regret as unpleasant but useful to us.
Yeah.
But, you know, also I think, you know, in your book, you point out that we don't like to feel regret. I mean, it signals something bad to us, like we made a mistake or we're, I don't know, losers. So one of my big regrets in my life is, so I studied in Canada 10 years ago and I moved back to Malaysia. And I'm always wondering, what if I stayed in Canada? You know, would life be different? Is there a way to make that what if productive, or is it just like a fantasy that I have to like visit now and then kind of wonder, but I can never
do that with us? Well, one thing is that Canada would be colder than Malaysia.
Absolutely.
So what's interesting about the what if is we often idealize things we did not do and think our life would be completely better in every respect. I mean, maybe that's exaggerating how you think about it, but I think a lot of times we idealize an alternative that we didn't pursue, but that may not be realistic. There may be pros and cons about living in Canada, pros and cons about living in Malaysia, and so forth. But even if it would have been better, objectively, to stay in Canada, you have to ask yourself, so what? So, you know, I bought Microsoft stock 25 years ago, and I sold it 20 years ago at a significant profit. But if I had kept it,
extremely
wealthy, right?
You wouldn't be on this podcast.
I would be on this. I would own this podcast. Yeah. But, but the fact is that what we often tend to think is that we have to keep comparing ourselves to the best outcome that we could imagine that we would have had. And so regret is the cancel emotion. What it does is it cancels out what is against the fantasy of what might have been. I mean, you could have lived in Canada and you could have been miserable. You could have had a relationship with a person who was terrible. Your work could have gone badly or whatever, or everything could have been great. But you don't know what it would have been. I think what we have to think about is anybody's life could have turned out better. That's potentially true about everybody in the world, right? I mean, everybody could have made a better decision somewhere. No one's making great decisions all the time. And this is what I kind of describe in my book as existential perfectionism, that if my life is not the best life it could have been, then it's not a good life to have.
And there seems to be a lot of pressure in society to live your best life. I mean, it's even the title of your book, right? Your best life now, as if it's attainable. And I really appreciate your point of, you know, like my fantasy of being Canada. Of course, in my fantasy, life is great. I don't fantasize a worse life because then I wouldn't regret my choice, right? So regret always accompanied with that what if of that a great fantasy.
Yeah,
that pales in comparison to my present reality, which seems, I guess, all of a sudden awful. And then you're saying that existential perfectionism. So if I look at this and I think I should have made perfect decisions, is that what existential perfectionism is?
Well, existential perfectionism involves the idea that I should have made perfect decisions, but it's also the idea that my life should be perfect, you know. Everything in my life should be perfect. My work, my finances, my appearance, my relationships, everything should be perfect. I think our culture, especially in America, our culture really pushes this idea that somehow if you do these things, you're going to have the perfect life. So an alternative way of thinking would be, what if I could aim for satisfaction? What if I could aim for contentment? One of the things that I describe in the book is there. Some people have a style of decision-making called maximization. And maximizers want to have the very, very best. They don't accept trade-offs. They want to have 100%. They take a long time making decisions because they're always looking for the best outcome. They think if I always look for the best outcome, then I will be satisfied. But it turns out, even though they take longer to make decisions, and even when objectively they get a better outcome, they're less satisfied because you're constantly comparing it to what they imagine the 100% would be. The alternative is a satisfier. Like I could be satisfied with, you know, less than perfect. I'm flexible about my expectations. You know, if I don't get the perfect outcome, I can say, well, you know, it's pretty good. Let me try to make the best of it. And even to aim for contentment. So imagine, it's like if we had a magic wand and we waved it over your head and you could become content with almost everything in your life and say, you know, this feels just right. It's not perfect, but, you know, I could be grateful. I could appreciate I have this. So many people have so much less. I'm going to aim for contentment and say yes to what I have. Life would be a lot easier.
It would be. Let me just push back on that. I mean, I'll say I agree with you, but I also have heard people saying, then you're not striving for enough. You settle too easily. Look at you, you know, satisfied with a mediocre life. You know, if you're, let's say you're a C-grade student, you shouldn't be content, right? Like you should, because contentment then puts you in complacency. And this could just be the Asian in me talking, and complacency and getting C's are bad, you know? And so our society, I think, tells us that contentment with something that is viewed as a lesser standard is not good.
It's equating contentment with complacency. That's like equating gratitude and appreciation with being an inferior, miserable human being who's a failure. I grew up, when I was a kid, we were very poor. I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, and we were very poor. And I got a scholarship to Yale and went to graduate school at Yale. And I think one of the advantages of growing up poor is to appreciate what I have and have gratitude for what I have. I've never heard anybody say, you know, the biggest mistake I ever made is to be grateful for things. Being grateful for things allows me to feel pretty happy and pretty secure. It's like, it's hard for me to think that I need something. You know, it's like, it's hard for somebody to buy me a present because I can't think of anything I really want that bad. You know, and it's not like I'm, you know, reject any material needs, or I'm not living in a tent out in the woods. But there's this kind of sense in which we think that gratitude and appreciation is going to keep us from striving. Two things. One, if I have security in my gratitude, appreciation, whatever, I can take risks. I can work on writing books that maybe nobody in the world will read because I don't need people to read the books. My life is not going to change if 10 more people read the book or 10 fewer people read the book. So in a way, having security allows some people to take more risks, to have more confidence in their beliefs, not be chasing after approval, not be tracing after false needs. And a lot of our culture really pushes false needs. It pushes, you need the new thing. You're missing out on something, you know, that kind of thing. But I think gratitude and appreciation and contentment give you a secure base. And that allows you to take risks, allows you to be creative. The second thing is, you don't have to be a perfectionist to have healthy, high standards. So one way of thinking about healthy, high standards is not necessarily to compete with other people, but to always think about how I can make myself somewhat better. So it's kind of like what researchers in the area of perfectionism call adaptive perfectionism, which is that, yes, I could have done better, but, you know, I can accept what I've done. I can learn from it. I can grow. I don't have to ruminate and criticize myself. And I think this kind of healthy high standards allows us to try hard, to learn from mistakes, to take risks. Some people who have perfectionistic standards won't work on something because it won't be perfect. And so they avoid taking on risks or new challenges.
And so would you say that people who regret have this idea that there should be no room for improvement? You know, like they have to get they have to get it right. You know, they have to hit the mark. That's it, right?
Yes. And it's kind of like Carol Dweck at Stanford describes growth mindsets versus fixed mindset. The fixed mindset, I have a fixed ability and I can't change. The growth mindset is, I can always grow. And I think one of the advantages of being self-reflective in life is to realize that you can always grow. I can always learn. I can always improve myself. And I find that exciting. I mean, it's like Aaron Beck, who died a couple of years ago, the founder of cognitive therapy, was 100 years old, and his mind was still in pretty good shape to the end. And he was listening to audiobooks. He was directing his research. He was co-authoring books up to a couple of weeks before he died. And so people who can focus on growth rather than criticism, rather than perfectionism gets in the way of growth, because then you don't want to try new things because, it's not going to be perfect. You know, I was talking with one of my editors about somebody who had gotten a contract for a book like 10 years or so before. You know, usually a contract is a year, right? And I said, I thought they wanted to write a book. And he said, a lot of people say they want to write a book, and what they really mean is I wish I had written a book. Yeah, because writing a book involves coming to terms with limitation. You know, mm-hmm. One thing, you have to be disciplined. Like, my way of writing is to set aside time several mornings a week for an hour and, you know, chunk out the writing over the course of the year. I don't always keep to that. But the second part is to recognize whatever you write is going to be incomplete. Some people think, oh, I have to include this. You're not going to write a 75-volume book on regret that nobody's going to read. So doing things incompletely, what I call successful imperfection, mm-hmm. You know, making progress, doing things imperfectly, repeatedly.
So does that mean, like, when you made a mistake, does that mean you don't feel regret because you've already kind of set your mind to it? Or do you still feel regret, but then use it in a different way?
Well, you can think about regret as a moment in time, as opposed to defining your life. So let's say I make a mistake, which I have done and I will do. If I make a mistake, notice it's a mistake, that was a mistake, and then correct it. Or if I said something that was unkind or unfair, to apologize, whatever. In other words, to say, okay, the regret can be momentary. Yeah, oh, that was a stupid thing. I shouldn't have done that. Then how can I correct it? How can I make amends if that's appropriate? And then move on to make my life better. So if I think about regret not as a bad emotion that I get stuck on and make myself feel worthless, but as an emotion that helps me grow to become a better person and to become a person who's able to accept the imperfections of myself and the imperfections of life.
Right. So in order for regret to be a productive emotion, we need to accept our limitations.
Absolutely.
That we have space to grow. And, you know, I like the way you describe it, because, I mean, with Carol Dweck's work, is forever growth, right? It's lifelong growth. And we're never attaining the standard. And that's something that I was reflecting on recently. I was reading a post by a young therapist, and I was like, when I was a young therapist, I thought one day I'll be a fantastic therapist and no one will ever feel bad about anything I say. Right. And then
I'm sorry, Kiss.
No. And then today I realized that will never happen. You know,
that therapist doesn't exist. And, you know, the thing that I'd like to think about is that all therapists are going to make mistakes. I'm going to make mistakes. You're going to make mistakes. All the therapists make mistakes. You know, the idea that you follow my program, it's going to be everything I say, you should take with a grain of salt, because mm-hmm. It's not going to work all the time. You know, this is not a panacea. This is not the Holy Grail. You know, this is not Tony Robbins. This is not going to change the world. This is mm-hmm. An idea. Try it. If it works sometimes, good for you. But what we often think about, we kind of glorify and idealize the different approaches that we have in therapy. It's like saying to somebody, you follow my advice in therapy and you are going to be cured of all your problems for the rest of your life. That's like you get the seasonal flu and the doctor says, you know, something sucks. You know, what's great is you got over this flu and I promise you'll never get sick again. Have a great life.
Great. You know?
That's the kind of doctor I want to go to.
Yeah.
You know, it's a witch doctor.
It's so cost effective too.
It's how to keep medical costs down. So life is about trade-offs, and it's about crossing a landscape with unknowns. So people who have two episodes of major depression lifetime are likely to have seven episodes. People who have OCD are likely to have reoccurrence. People with generalized anxiety disorder likely to have reoccurrence, and so forth. So we often think in all or nothing terms, as opposed mm-hmm. to, hey, we'll help you get some advantage here, but you'll have problems in the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, for example, right. if you take the idea of ambivalence, like mm-hmm. ambivalence has a bad name, right? It's kind of like, oh, I'm really ambivalent. I shouldn't be ambivalent. I shouldn't make a decision if I'm ambivalent. I've seen many people think, oh, I can't make a decision about getting married or breaking up because I'm ambivalent, right? First of all, if you don't break up, you've made a decision to stay, right? The second thing is ambivalence. I had one patient who thought, I can't get married. I've known this woman for 5 years. I still have ambivalence. And I said, well, one of the reasons you might have ambivalence is that you know each other. You know, it's kind of like, I mean, think about your best friend. You have the ambivalence right. about her. They have ambivalence about you, right?
Mixed feelings.
We all have mixed feelings because people are complex. You have mixed feelings about yourself, right? You know, I mean, you might be a terrific person, but I'm sure that you don't like every single thing you've ever said or done, right? So accepting ambivalence recognizes, you know, life is about complexity. We're all filled with contradiction. You know, good people do bad things. Good decision makers make bad decisions. If we can accept that, we can live in the real world.
Yeah. And one of the things that you point out in your book, so it's ambivalence, and also that we have to accept that, and you said every stage in our lifespan is an opportunity for regret. It's like we can't escape it. And, you know, I can hear someone saying, but, you know, you're talking about making amends and correcting, but what if I can never correct it? You know, what if this is too big a mistake? Right. And how do I get over my regret? You know, you're saying like it's so easy, Bob. You know, that is not so easy.
No, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm saying it's difficult. And like, for example, I can never get over it, or I could never get past it, whatever. You know, people sometimes talk about closure. You know, let's get closure on this, right? Let's get closure on your experience growing up within your family and get closure on all those issues. I think that's absurd. I think that life is always going to be about unfinished business. You know, you're not drawing a circle and say, here, teacher, I finished my assignment. I'm finished. Here's the circle. It's a closed circle, right? Life is unfinished business. For one thing, we don't remember everything that happened. You know, we experience the past in terms of our point of view currently and what we learn currently. We can't go back and change things that happened in the past. So life is about unfinished business. And so that's fine. That's fine. You don't have to finish everything to get on with your life today. If you accept that incompleteness is an inevitable part of almost everything in life, friendships, relationships, romantic experiences, work, spiritual things, everything involves unfinished business. The other thing is the issue of ambivalence. If we think about, like, you know, Walt Whitman, a great American poet, the 19th century, who said, you know, I love the rich and the poor, the ugly and the beautiful, the old and the young. I love all of you. You might say, I contradict myself. Very well. I am large. I am filled with multitudes. In other words, I'm large. I can accept my contradictions. And I think that sometimes we tend to think in black and white terms that, oh, this person should be this way 100% of the time. Like, everybody, in my view, is a fallen angel who's made many mistakes and will make mistakes in the future. That's reality.
And I get, you know, something where regret is, I think when, well, in my life, when regret was particularly strong was when I made the event to mean something about me.
Yeah.
You know, like I wasn't loving, you know, but I thought I was a loving person, but this signified, you know, even though it was a mistake, that I wasn't loving enough, I wasn't good enough. And and then it really, I think one of the reasons why it's hard to get over it and maybe use regret productively to grow is that it's hard to accept that about myself, right? Because it brings to question how I think about myself, my identity. Am I not loving, you know? And if only I could undo that event, that would mean I am loving, you know?
Well,
and it's so hard to accept the reality.
You're looking for perfectionism about Sook. That Sook has to be... Sucking was in Latin, the most suck that anybody can be. That, yeah, you're looking for that existential perfection, the Holy Grail, which doesn't exist. An alternative is what I call, adaptive humility. And, you know, a lot of times in our culture, we think that we may equate humility with, you know, being inferior or weak or always being critical of yourself. But adaptive humility is a different kind of thing. And it's sort of like I'm a human being. I'm going to make mistakes. I'm no better than other people. I can learn from them. I'll make mistakes in the future. I can accept that. I can grow from that. I can show compassion for myself. But don't think of myself as some kind of godlike or superior, perfect person, and don't aim for it. The advantage of adaptive humility is that you can accept mistakes, you can accept regret, you can move on from it, you can be forgiving of other people, forgiving of yourself, and you can feel like you belong to the human race. People who endorse the values of adaptive humility, there's actually research on this humility issue, that people have better relationships, they have better marriages, they have better relationships, friendships. And it stands to reason, who wants to be involved with a narcissist? Who wants to work with a narcissist?
So interesting, Bob. Yeah. Let me just, cut that. Because we don't think of ourselves as narcissists, right? You know, the one who's always self-critical with that existential perfectionism. We don't think, I don't think, oh man, it's because I'm a narcissist and I have this. In fact, I think I am being humble by being self-critical.
Well, it's a kind of thing where we hold ourselves up to an idealized standard that I should be the ideal person. So I'm using that term narcissist in a way that's different from the way clinicians do. It's like viewing me as the paragon of virtue. I should be the best person in the world. The idea of adaptive humility is I'm living in the real world, that I'm going to make mistakes. I don't know everything. My emotions sometimes get the best of me. I can always have room for growth. That doesn't mean I have to criticize myself or hate myself or feel inferior. And I can learn from other people's mistakes. That's another way of being humble, that, you know, I can learn from the things that other people do and say, hey, wow, that didn't work for you. I should maybe learn from that. So adaptive humility allows us to be flexible, allows us to have gratitude, and allows us to accept ourselves. It's hard to have a lot of regret if you have adaptive humility.
It's hard to have a lot of regret, but you're also saying having some regret is good. Because you said, like, if we never feel regret. You know, I like the example in your book, right? If you meet someone on a dating app and the person says, I never feel any regret, like red flags, you may not want to go close to that person, because that person may be a sociopath and, you know, not growing wiser, not learning at all. So it seems like our, you know, where a healthy place is, I won't say an ideal place, but just a healthy place, accepting we have limitations, accepting that we will regret some things that is inevitable in our lives. Should it then be a goal to minimize regret, or just go like, it would happen, let me just grow?
Right. If you think about regret as a moment in time, like if you think about your life as a journey in a train, you're on a train and regret is one stop in the train. So let's say you have regret about that past relationship and decisions, things you said. So that's a stop on the train. Okay. So you stop on the train, have the regret, and you think, okay, what did I say or do that I regret? How could I learn from that? How could I use that in the future? How could I make amends? And then move on to your journey to the next station, the next stop on the journey. What happens with some people is they stop on the regret station. They get out. They pace back and forth for 5 years, ruminating, criticizing themselves, avoiding other people because they think they can't get involved with anybody.
They build a regret hotel and live there.
I love that. I love that regret hotel. That's great. I'm going to use that. I'm going to steal your ideas. So, Yeah, so you regret telling me that. So yeah,
I have a really adaptive humility. I share my ideas freely.
Thank you, and send me your money as well. So, but you know, it's an interesting thing because some people end up defining themselves by their regret. You know, like somebody will say, "Oh, you know this person that you knew before? Well, they did this thing. It's like a bad thing." Aren't they a terrible person? And I think, you know, we all make mistakes. I don't want to define a human being by a decision that they made. You know, we all make stupid decisions, but we tend to do this. Well, this person is a terrible person. This person's worthless. This person's that, you know, maybe they are, but my view is that everybody is capable of redemption, of learning. Everybody makes mistakes. I'm going to make mistakes in the future. So will you. So will everybody who's listening. But we have to have tools to deal with the mistakes we make. Regret is a tool if you use it to say, oh, that was a mistake. What did I learn? What information was I ignoring? What information was I basing it on? And how could I use this in the future? And is it appropriate maybe for me to apologize? So somebody called me up. I mean, sent me an email a couple of years ago apologizing for something they said to me 25 years ago. This is somebody who worked for me. And I was very moved by this. And so I wrote back and I said, look, you know, things were difficult. You were going through a rough time. I don't hold on to grudges. I forgive you. I wasn't perfect. Maybe we could get together and have dinner at some point, you know. From my point of view, accepting his humanity and his courage in reaching out was redemptive for him and for me, that it helped him. He's a human being. He's not a bad person. And it helped me. I don't want to hold on to grudges. I think guilt and grudges should have an expiration date. They should have a shelf life, right? Mm-hmm. Like you buy chicken and it has a expiration date of 1 week. We should think the same thing about regret and guilt.
Kind of like use it, learn from it, and then move on. Get back on the train and keep going. Yeah.
Get back on the train.
Don't pay rent. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't, you know, there should be a statute of limitations on regret and guilt.
And your beautiful example is also towards others, right? It's not just like a self-treatment I let myself go, or I have self-compassion, or I forgive myself. This is also about allowing other people to be able to move on and to release them from that. And I think, you know, some people's fear is that they don't deserve it. You know, like, why should I let go? I want them to regret this for the rest of your life.
Yeah, we get a lot into this deserving thing. And I think a lot of things in life is getting things that have nothing to do with deserving. Like, I wrote a book. I didn't deserve to write a book. I wrote the book. I did the hard work. I took the risks. I put a lot of time into it. It's like I say, deserve to write a book or whatever. But if we get away from this deserving, because then it gets into this kind of moralistic thinking about, you know, you're a bad person, so you don't deserve anything, or you're a good person, or you're a victim, so you deserve everything. I think that leads us down some unproductive roles. If we think about, what do I want? This is what my concept of personal empowerment. What do I want? What do I have to do to get it? And am I willing to do it? So, for example, let's say somebody wants to lose 15 pounds. That's what I want to do. I want to lose 15 pounds. What do I have to do to achieve that goal? I have to diet and exercise. Am I willing to do it? Willing to do it doesn't mean, do you want to do it, or do you deserve to do it? Do you deserve to lose 15 pounds or whatever? It's simply, am I willing to do the right things to achieve the right goals? Am I willing to tolerate discomfort? Am I willing to make decisions? Am I willing to do things I don't want to do? The deserving thing, you know, you could say that we should treat everybody as having human rights, which I agree. We should treat everybody the way we would want to be treated. I think most religions agree with that. But if we get into this deserving, like I deserve to be successful, or I don't deserve to be forgiven. If I say, you should forgive me. Like when you hear people try to deal with infidelity, you know, say the husband's been unfaithful and it's been found out. And he says to the wife, well, you should forgive me. You should forgive me. I apologize. You should forgive me and move on. That's never going to work. If anything, it's going to make her even more distrustful because mm-hmm. he feels like he's trying to minimize it, dismiss it, get off it. What he could say is, you have every right never to forgive me. In fact, if I were in your position, I might not forgive me. I hope you do. I hope you give me a chance. But I can understand why you'd have a lot of anger about me and not want to be with me. That kind of authentic, sincere apology that's not based on entitlement, not based on being deserving to be forgiven, I think is more effective. It's recognizing the other person has a right not to forgive you.
I'm just translating it to, you know, on how people can also say it's hard to forgive themselves and have that, you know, the husband with, let's say, with the affair, he might not forgive himself. Yeah, and whether that, you know, that approach would work if he sort of turns it on himself and go, okay, you know, I did something that I deeply regret and it's going to be hard to live with. Yeah. But I do hope that I can maybe learn and grow from this. Is that that approach to help with the regret?
Yeah. So if you think about guilt as a tool for self-forgiveness, think about it this way, that if I feel guilty about something I did, I think, oh, I can't believe what a stupid thing. I really disappointed the other person. It was unfair. I disappoint myself, whatever. If you get in touch with that authentic guilt and you're kind of worn down by it in that moment in time, in a way that leads to forgiveness, it's kind of like, yes, this person, me, feels really bad about it. And so now I can ask for forgiveness to this other person, but I can actually work for forgiveness for myself. And how do I work toward forgiveness for myself? One is I think about a compassionate part of myself. The two parts, the part that feels guilty, the part that loves and cares for me, and the compassion part of myself. That's the part we'll say, yeah, so Bob, you did that stupid thing. You know, I can love you even if you've done some stupid things. And I think this is the real test of love for somebody else, if they do something that you don't like, is to use your love as a tool to overcome your judgment. I love you enough that I can accept you and still be your friend or your partner, even though you've said something or done something that hurt me. To use love as a tool to overcome judgment. The second part of productive guilt is to think about, now I'm going to use my guilt to motivate me to become a better person. And being a better person is not hating myself. That's actually treating myself badly. That's not going to make me a better person. Being a better person is being a better person. It's doing the right thing. It's being kind, being generous, giving forgiveness to other people. And I think that's a way in which we can think about these emotions like regret or guilt or jealousy or envy as a point in time. And what's the next thing you're going to do? How are you going to use this?
I mean, it's, yeah, as you said, definitely not easy. It gives a lot for me to think about, and I think a lot for our listeners to think about, on how to use these, what we feel as not just pieces of information, but also guides on what's the next thing, you know, where else should I go? But it's also not, I'll never do it again. Because as you say, we will make mistakes again, you know. Absolutely. We will fall again, and it's not, the regret isn't going to lead us to be perfect. It's just maybe going to lead us to change one thing, you know, or behave differently, or as you say, make amends or to apologize, which already, you know, puts us in the right direction. Is there, you know, so someone who's listening and is really struggling with regret of like a big thing that just says, okay, you know, I can't make amends because that's a person has passed, you know, so it's like something big. Where should they start?
That's the unfinished business. So the person has died, so you can't apologize to them. You can't get them to forgive you. A couple of things you can do. One is, even though they've died, you can write a letter apologizing, owning up to your responsibility or your shortcomings, in a way to say, I know you died. I know I wasn't a good daughter or son or partner or friend, whatever. And I wanted to share with you, I really feel bad about that. And I know you can't forgive me because you're no longer here, but I needed to say it. I needed to get it out and say it and to experience my saying that. The second thing is how I'm going to learn to be a better person in the future. If we reframe regret as the road to improvement, right? How am I going to improve this? How am I going to make myself a better person? And we think about, you can always aim for being a better person, but regret, being stuck on regret, is like being stuck on the first floor. You want to get to the top, and maybe you'll never get to the top, but you can get to higher and higher levels. And so you think about, yeah, I could really learn from that experience. Thank you for reminding me about the mistakes that all of us are capable of making. How can I improve myself? And isn't that a positive and practical thing to do, to improve? Ruminating is not going to be practical. Just dwelling on it over and over. Criticizing myself is not going to make anything better. Getting stuck in the past, avoiding things in the future, that's not improvement. But taking regret and using it as a platform, I'm going to improve myself. I'm going to try to be, you know, I'll give you an example of my own writing. About 22 years ago, I wrote a book called Overcoming Resistance in Cognitive Therapy. And one of the areas of resistance I could see were people felt like the therapist wasn't validating them. And I recognized that at times I wasn't validating my patients. And it was part of my, you know, inflated ego that I had all the techniques, whatever. And so I realized that part of the resistance was me. I wasn't validating. I was problem solving, rational, lecturing, you know, the whole thing. So
it was actually overcoming Bob.
Right. It's overcoming Bob, volume one, the early years. But it was kind of an epiphany. It was kind of like, the patient is right. The therapist is wrong. And I wish I could take back all the invalidation that they may have experienced. But you know something? I can learn from them. I'm not like some genius who has all the answers. I'm somebody who can learn. That's very empowering. I mean, if I can't learn from my patients, I'm really going to be handicapped.
It's such a simple line, right? But I'm a person who can learn. Then you're not stuck on your mistake. It's okay in a way.
You know? Yeah. The word mistake has a bad reputation. Uh-huh. It was like, think about mistake as new knowledge, as an experiment, right?
Yeah.
If we no longer use the word mistake, it was a canceled word, and we now have the word new information, everybody would be happy with that.
I made opportunities for new information today.
There we go.
There we go. Well, thanks, Bob. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too, sir. Great to see you.
And great to see you.
Thank you for listening to the Being Human podcast. To find out more about Relate Malaysia's online therapy services, visit us at www.relate.com.my or email us at inquires@relate.com.my. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, remember, we are all more human than we are otherwise. Be kind to yourself and take care.